The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library. I'm Leslie Miller, the first vice chair of the Free Library Foundation, and we're delighted to have you all here this evening. We are so pleased that the Free Library Foundation is able to enrich the Free Library's essential services and the quality of the programs, like this author series that you're about to participate in tonight. We do so, of course, through our philanthropy. So, and this is my plug for the evening, we're hoping that in addition to having a good time here this evening, you'll leave with the consideration of making a contribution to the Free Library, to helping us continue to enrich literacy and the nature of our programs. You can do so by going to freelibrary.org/support, and we thank you very much for thinking about us on your way out. Now it's my personal privilege to introduce Wayne Pacelli, who's the president and CEO of the Humane Society. He's an individual that I have known and admired and fortunately been able to meet and be able to share with you here tonight. As head of the Humane Society, which has become the world's largest animal protection agency, Mr. Pacelli leads 11 million members and constituents in confronting animal cruelty. He's worked tirelessly for the passage of 500 new state laws and the enactment of 50 federal statutes. As Carla Hall reported in the LA Times, Pacelli has retooled a venerable organization, seen as a mild-mannered protector of dogs and cats, into an aggressive group flexing muscle in state legislatures and courtrooms. The bond is Mr. Pacelli's engaging and urgent rallying cry to repair our relationship with the animal kingdom. Says Jane Goodall, if the animals knew about this book, they would, without a doubt, confer on Wayne Pacelli their highest honor, and we certainly agree. So we're all delighted to welcome him here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in greeting Wayne Pacelli.
It was a good choice for Jane Goodall. Good evening. Thank you all for coming. And Leslie, thank you so much for that very warm and generous introduction. I'm really pleased to be with you, Leslie, and all of you here tonight. And I'm pleased to be at the Free Library, the Free Public Library of Philadelphia. And I was thinking about this just a few minutes ago that, I was thinking of the writer of myth, Joseph Campbell, the late Joseph Campbell, and he talked about the structures in a community really kind of representing the values of a community. And in seeing this beautiful free public library, this great big building, it speaks to the values of a community. You know, it speaks to the value of education and the importance of that in a community. Just like a big, beautiful, glistening bank says something about commerce in the community, or a big, beautiful church or set of churches says something about faith in a community. So I think that it's so important. Education and literacy are the foundation of a thoughtful society. We can't get to animal protection. We can't get to these important issues if people aren't educated and aware. So this is a base, and I want to reiterate Leslie's urging that you think about supporting this institution. I've been traveling around. The book just opened up or launched on April 5th, and I've been on the road since then and came down from Boston this morning, and we've been traveling all over the country. It's been great to see the response to the book. In its first week, it got to number 11 on the New York Times bestseller list, and I was really excited about that. You know, there are a lot of books now about animals, but not that many that are being read by an enormous number about animal advocacy and some of the problems with animals. And I wrote this book to elevate the national discussion about these issues and to try to set a new course for our society about how animals are treated. And I called it The Bond because I really had a bond and a sense of kinship with other creatures ever since I can remember. And I'm sure it's true for so many of you that you really didn't need any instruction on the idea of being good and decent animals, that so many kids have that first impulse to be drawn to other creatures. And, you know, I knew, just as I'm sure you did when you were a kid, that animals were different, but they're different in good ways. They have beautiful fur, they have beautiful eyes, they're athletic, they run fast. And to my mind, those differences were not disqualifying in terms of my treating them fairly. Those differences kind of augmented my concern. I mean, I thought they were all the more interesting and in some ways all the more worthy of my protection because they were different. And I'm the youngest of four kids, and all my siblings are wonderful people. My parents are wonderful. They just weren't aware of these issues. And it wasn't as if they said, Wayne, you know, let me give you a primer on rescuing animals, or let me give you instruction on how to care for other creatures. It was just in me. And I'm sure that is the case with so many of you. And the first part of this book, I actually try to explain why and how we're connected to other creatures. Because it's not unusual for us, for you and me, to be drawn to these creatures. Sometimes we think, well, we have this, you know, very strong interest in animals and animal advocacy. Maybe I'm a little different from other people because of that concern. But you look at our society, and you look at the fact that we have 171 million dogs and cats in our households. Two-thirds of Americans have pets in the household, dogs and cats. There are another 150 or 170 million other pets in our homes that are not dogs and cats. 350 million of them in our homes. We spend well more than $50 billion on vet services and food and toys and other products to serve these creatures. And then in terms of the wild, we have 70 million of us who are wildlife watchers. We take to the forests or the fields, or we go outside to see birds. We're watching birds. We've got our binoculars, or we've got our cameras, or we just have our walking stick. We see mammals. Some of us go on whale watching boats. And we spend another $50 billion on wildlife watching activities. We have Animal Planet on television now. We have books and magazines about animals. I mean, what is it in us that draws us to these creatures in so many ways? And I argue in the book, you know, a few things. One, we're a social creature. I mean, the worst thing to do to a prisoner is to put him or her in solitary confinement. A person goes mad in solitary confinement. We need other humans around. We need others in order to feel full and complete and healthy. Well, animals serve that function for us as well. And animals have always been part of the human story. Ever since our days of hunting and gathering, and today, if you look at tribal communities in Brazil or New Guinea, you see that the members of these communities know all the behaviors of all the animals. They know all the plants. They depend on nature and a deep and keen understanding of nature to survive. And animals are killed in these hunting and gathering communities, but there are rituals of atonement. There are apologies offered to the animals. And one interesting finding that I report on in the book is that a lot of these tribal societies actually keep pets, not domesticated animals, but wild animals as pets. We are drawn to animals, and we have always been drawn to animals as a species. You know, even if you look at the era of domestication, when wild animals came into our lives and the whole human equation was changed, dogs first 15,000 years ago and then pigs and goats and sheep. I mean, one might say that was an example of kind of humans subjugating animals, dominating them for our purposes, but there's also a kinship there. There's a connection between us and them that was manifest in the very idea of domestication. And then you kind of look at our modern era. Not only the wildlife watching, the pet keeping that I mentioned, but all the philanthropy that exists for animals. There are 10,000 animal welfare organizations in the United States, whether they're local humane societies or SPCAs or rescue groups, whether it's feral cat rescue or golden retriever rescue, whatever it is. In fact, there are so many different groups representing just about every conceivable species. There are whale and dolphin conservation groups. There are elephant protection groups. There are mountain lion protection groups. There are guinea pig protection organizations. There are rabbit protection organizations. You know, we support a rabbit sanctuary at HSUS in South Carolina for injured and homeless rabbits. And our motto is, at the rabbit sanctuary, we provide hope for the hopless. And, you know, every creature has its defenders out there. And when you add it all up, this is an incredible commitment of volunteerism and philanthropy and emotional concern about all the creatures of the world. But the flip side of that is, why do we need 10,000 animal organizations in our society? How is it so bad that we need that many groups and that many people devoting so much energy to stopping so much cruelty? And this is one of the central arguments in the bond, is that we are living in this incredible moment of contradiction. We are at this incredible time when there's more goodness and more decency for animals than ever, with all of this philanthropy and all of this activism. But we're also at a moment when there's so much exploitation and so much harm. Whether it's the 10,000 puppy mills that groups like Mainline Animal Rescue are battling to stop the abuse of these dogs on the mills, or whether it's combating factory farming, the confinement of animals raised for food in our industrial food production system, or whether it's the killing of animals for fur, whether it's the seals in Canada or the bobcats in Pennsylvania who are trapped with leghorn traps, whether it's the abuse of wild animals in the circus like elephants. I mean, you name it. I mean, I could go on and on and on about all of these problems that exist in society. And how can this happen in the very same culture? How can we have so many expressions of good yet also be so callous and cruel to these other creatures? And I try to disentangle that in this book. And I essentially argue that, you know, we've kind of settled the basic debate already, that cruelty to animals is wrong. We don't find anybody, really anywhere, that now defends animal cruelty. In fact, all 50 states have laws against cruelty. We have general anti-cruelty statutes that forbid malicious and gratuitous violence toward individual animals. We have laws against dogfighting. We have laws against cockfighting. That argument is settled. Cruelty to animals is wrong. The problem for us as a society is, how are we applying this attitude or this idea in a world where animal use is so widespread, where the use of animals is part of the economy, and where the use of animals is interwoven with our daily lives and our behaviors that we do every single day? That's essentially the central question that we confront every day at the Humane Society of the United States, and it's the reason I wrote this book. And I wrote it because I think we can find a way out of this. I think we can figure out a way to live our lives in a good way, to have a robust economy, to maintain a good quality of life, but not to leave a trail of animal victims in the process. It's not a choice of being good to people or being good to animals. It's a question of doing both and figuring out with the innovation and creativity of the human mind ways to achieve both purposes. And I really believe that this bond gives us the head start. It gives us a head start in doing the right thing for our fellow creatures. But it can skid off the tracks, and we can become selfish. We can become narrowly focused on certain traditions or economic practices. And we have an incredible ability to rationalize our conduct as humans. I mean, we can rationalize all sorts of things. And, you know, I think that more and more we're recognizing and realizing that other animals matter. You know, I don't talk so much about animal rights. I talk about human responsibility. It's really more about us than it is about them. I mean, there's a basic framework we need to accept about animals, that they feel, that they suffer. They're not just biological machines kind of mechanically reproducing and consuming food and operating only by instinct. That was the biological box we put them in for quite a long time. But we know from our own common sense observations of animals and from all sorts of science that we can see that's right in front of us, that animals experience a wide range of emotions. They are capable of happiness and joy. They are capable of sadness and loneliness and everything in between. And they may not be able to speak like we can. They may not be as intelligent as we are, certainly not by the way that we measure intelligence. But should that be disqualifying for them? Isn't it more important that they are our equals when it comes to suffering than our equals when it comes to intelligence? And if we are so intelligent, shouldn't we use our mind to figure out ways for us to live a good life and not to cause them harm? You know, yesterday's necessities, like wearing a fur coat, are today's minor conveniences. We have options. We can wear a beautiful synthetic coat or a cloth coat and achieve all the same purposes that that coat is designed for. Style, beauty, warmth, comfort. We don't have to trap 40 bobcats. We don't have to kill the mink. We don't have to club the seals. We can figure our way out of it. A simple, minor course correction in our behavior has enormous implications for these other creatures. You know, I think of factory farming where these animals are crammed into cages and crates, sometimes barely larger than their bodies. Pigs in 2-foot by 7-foot cages called gestation crates, they can't even turn around for 3 years that they're alive. Or laying hens, 6 or 8 birds jammed into a small wire cage. Each bird gets 67 square inches of space, less living space than the front or the back of an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. I mean, that's the living space that the bird has for 1.5 or 2 years that they're alive. You know, I think of how agriculture has turned in the last 50 years toward this model of factory farming. It's become so harsh and so unforgiving to these creatures who give their lives for people to consume them or their reproductive products. And I think of factory farming really in some ways as an incredible human innovation. But it's an incredible human innovation detached from conscience. I mean, we can't have a society where we have our economic institutions that are divorced from our ethical principles. I mean, we've got to marry them. That's what makes us a good and decent society. I mean, here in Philadelphia, a city with so much history, a city with such a role in the founding of this country, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. I mean, embedded in all of these documents, the founding documents of our country, not only democratic decision-making, not only the right to free speech, but basic principles like fairness and justice and the rights of the individual. You know, when we enshrined those principles in our founding documents, we doomed practices that were at odds with those beliefs. It took us a long time, but we had to confront the issue of slavery. It took 8 decades after the founding of the country to finally eradicate the evil of chattel slavery, but we had to do it because it was so inconsistent with the principles that we talk about. And eventually people are going to sync up these ideas with their behavior. It took a lot of agitation. It took a great civil war that claimed the lives of 600,000 people. But that issue needed to be settled. You can't have a democracy when you disenfranchise half the people either. We had to confront women's suffrage. We had to deal with that question of just allowing men to vote and forget about the women. It took us until 1920 to get there, but the principles of our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence made us go there eventually. Should have come much sooner, but it came. And what about these other creatures? Are we going to suspend these principles of decency and goodness to other creatures? We're going to live our lives and just apply these principles to our dealings with humans and then forget about it when it comes to these vulnerable, innocent, sentient creatures? Well, not if we're thinking, not if we're alert to the suffering of other creatures, not if we claim to live by a creed or a code of altruism or other-centeredness. We've got to grapple with this issue. And my God, it's 2011. Can't we figure out a way to do it? You know, I take the reader in the bond to many different places I've been, all over the country and some parts of the world. I took the reader up to the ice floes of Canada. This has been on my mind this last week because just last week, the largest marine mammal slaughter in the world was launched again. And it's the killing of these harp seals and hooded seals in Atlantic Canada. And when I've been up there, I'm always struck by what's going on at this hunt. You know, to me, it's an incredible wildlife spectacle. 6 million seals come down from Greenland, down the Atlantic seaboard of Canada, past the coast of Quebec, down to Labrador and Newfoundland and Prince Edward Island, and they give birth, the mothers give birth to the baby seals on the vast ice sheets to the east of the North American continent. There are no polar bears, and the seals are about as helpless and defenseless a creature as you can find. They're with their mothers for 10 days, 12 days actually. The mother produces a high, fat, nutrient-rich milk for them. They grow fast, and then the mother skitters off the ice and goes on her own way. And the baby is left helpless. She can't swim or he can't swim, you know, for a few weeks. Can't run because they have fins and flippers, not legs. And men in boats come with guns and clubs to kill them by the thousands and thousands. Not for local consumption because no one uses the furs at all in Canada. Not for the meat, because they leave the carcasses to rot on the ice or in the water. They do it to sell the pelts to the diminishing number of markets in the world that are willing to purchase this fur, which they often dye and they tan. It doesn't even look like the seal pelt much at all. And when I'm up there, I think, I mean, this is the old economy at work. This is what we used to do in the United States when we slaughtered the buffalo or we slaughtered the passenger pigeons. I mean, it's just like grabbing and killing and then running and leaving a wake of destruction behind us. It was that attitude that led to the near extermination of the bison in the Great Plains of the North American continent. There were 40 to 60 million bison in the span of 3 decades. We brought their numbers down to 500. There were billions and billions of passenger pigeons, and we wiped them out entirely. And it's actually in that period, in the middle part of the 19th century, when we were destroying the wildlife. And in our newly emerging cities like Philadelphia and New York and Boston, where people were being transported by horses, and people saw horses being whipped and overworked. And people said, stop that. It was in that moment of crisis that the Humane Movement first formed in the late 1860s here in Philadelphia in 1867 with the Women's Humane Society and SPCA and the Massachusetts SPCA and the American SPCA. And the first conservation groups formed around that time to say, hey, we've got to slow down this destruction of animals and nature. We've got to place some limits and restraints on our behavior. And when I'm up in Canada, I think, my God, how many people in this day and age, in 2011, are interested in clubbing and killing seals or even wearing their fur? I mean, of the 40 million Canadians, of the 310 million Americans, of the hundreds of millions or billions of people in the world, is it some tiny, tiny little fraction of 0.1% of the people who would be interested in doing that? How many of us, how many millions, how many tens of millions would like to do what I did, which is see this incredible wildlife spectacle, to see all of these seals and their mothers in this lunar-looking landscape, the ice floes as far as you can see, squinting, having my eyes almost closed because the sun is refracting from these ice floes. And you see these vulnerable, helpless creatures, but you see this majesty of nature. I mean, what if you monetize that? That's the new humane economy. That's the world we want to build. That's the world where you marry your economic interests and you marry your values. You know, when you divorce them, you have things like slavery, and you have things like child labor. When you marry them together, you have a wonderful society that is robust and that is doing things consistent with its values. You know, we've been forgetting, you know, too much about the animals. And it's time for us to remind ourselves about our responsibilities to them. You know, just a brief reading from the preface of the book. As harsh as nature is for animals, cruelty comes only from human hands. We are the creature of conscience, aware of the wrongs we do, and fully capable of making things right. Our best instincts will always tend in that direction, because a bond with animals is built into every one of us. That bond of kinship and fellow feeling has been with us through the entire arc of human experience. From our first barefoot steps on the planet, through the era of domestication of animals, and into the modern age. For all that sets humanity apart, animals remain our companions in creation, to borrow a phrase from Pope Benedict XVI, bound up with us in the story of life on earth. Every act of callousness toward an animal is a betrayal of that bond. In every act of kindness, we keep faith with the bond. And broadly speaking, the whole mission of the animal welfare cause is to repair the bond, for their sake and for our own. In our day, there are stresses and fractures of the human-animal bond, and some forces at work would sever it once and for all. They pull us in the wrong direction and away from the decent and honorable code that makes us care for creatures who are entirely at our mercy. Especially within the last 200 years, we've come to apply an industrial mindset to the use of animals, too often viewing them as if they were nothing but articles of commerce and the raw material of science, agriculture, and wildlife management. Here, as in other pursuits, human ingenuity has a way of outrunning human conscience. And some things we do only because we can, forgetting to ask whether we should. You know, I just look at this problem, and I, in my daily work at HSUS, you know, I see the best of humanity. I see people like you who care, you know, who are striving to live your lives in a way that's consistent with your values. You're self-sacrificing, you're giving of yourself. You really do imagine a better world. And then, unfortunately, I see the worst of humanity. I see people who are selfish and callous and cruel, oftentimes just not contemplating really the actual consequences of their conduct. You know, just being kind of slavish to tradition or custom or economic interests. And I just know that this is not something that we can tolerate as a society. And I've seen, the movement forward in our society, and I look at the progress that we've made just in my own 25 years of activism on this issue. I mean, an issue that used to be kind of considered a little strange, it was on the margins. Now it's really a mainstream concern. And it's not just cases like the dogfighting case with Michael Vick that brought that issue to the attention of the public, or an investigation that we did at a slaughter plant in California that showed the abuse of downed animals, but even something like Katrina and the response that the American public had to the animals there, and the demonstration of the incredible human-animal bond that was exhibited during this whole Katrina crisis. It was a terrible calamity that affected a big swath of the coastal southeast and threatened a great American city, New Orleans. And, of course, 1,200 people perished because of the powerful hurricane. Hundreds of thousands were displaced, losing their homes and not knowing whether they're going to have a job or whether they could ever come back to their community if there was anything left of it. And there was this parallel sort of, concern that began after the first few days to develop, that we saw an animal, staring out of a second floor window where the home had been abandoned, or there was a cat clinging to a rooftop in a flooded city. And our hearts went out to the people, but they also went out to the animals. And then as the whole kind of drama progressed, and private groups and public organizations, whether the Navy or the Coast Guard, went to rescue people in distress with all the right motivations, they found so many people. Remember, 2/3 of American households have pets, and 2/3 of the people in these communities had pets as well. And so many of them who stayed behind because they didn't have a place to bring their animals. And then the rescuers came, and they took their boats up to a flooded house where there was no electricity, of course, and the food had spoiled and there was no drinkable water. And they said, here I am, we're going to take you back to safety, you're going to be okay. And so many of the people said, thank you so much for coming. I'm really suffering here, and I don't care about any of my possessions. I'm just going to take my two cats with me. I'm going to take my one dog. And the rescuers had no guidance on this. And they said, I'm sorry, we can take you, but not the animals. And so many people, one after another, said, well, thanks for the offer, but I'm staying behind. I'm not going to abandon my best friends during their greatest time of distress. And it was an example of the human-animal bond in evidence that so many people are connected to animals. So many people are willing to sacrifice. So many people do care about other creatures. And one final reading, just before we conclude, this is in the pets chapter of the book, and it's about those harrowing days after Katrina struck and when we were working so hard to rescue so many thousands of animals. Maybe some of you came down. So many people did deploy. Just two paragraphs. In a lifetime of being around animals, I'd seen some strange and interesting things. But here was something completely different. I was standing in the front galley of a Continental Airlines 727 that was soon to depart Baton Rouge Airport, surveying a plane packed with passengers, all of them dogs. It was like something from a Far Side cartoon, complete with chipper flight attendants serving dog biscuits and water. Given the desperate circumstances, everyone was quiet and well-behaved, and the sound of the captain's voice had ears up and heads tilted. Not one of the 140 dogs on board was barking or whining, not even the ones stuck in the middle seats. There was something comical in the scene, but also deeply touching, seeing all these frightened faces wondering what was happening to them. Yet, however afraid they might have felt at the moment, every one of them was lucky to be leaving New Orleans in the days after Hurricane Katrina. These guys had already been through a lot. They'd been abandoned when the city was evacuated, left to fend for themselves as the waters rose, their food ran out, and they found themselves all alone in an empty house. When finally they heard a friendly voice, It wasn't their owners, but one of the hundreds of rescuers who had come to help. Now they were bound for California, where others would take them in until one day soon, if everything worked out, their owners would find them and take them back home. What mattered most right now was to get them to safety and worry about the reunions later. You know, and I think of this as just such a moment where we woke up as a nation to the power of this connection between us and animals. And we just need to apply it more consistently. And one final thought, which is, I've got a lot of characters in the book, and one character is a guy named Chuck Anderson. And Chuck Anderson is a guy who found himself kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he was out swimming in the Gulf of Mexico, enjoying the day, a warm summer day, and suddenly a bull shark rushed him. And the shark, before he knew it, bit him and severed four of his fingers. The shark made another turn, came back at him, he parried the blow, and then he made a third run at Chuck, and this time delivered the most grievous wound of the wounds that he sustained. And he bit off Chuck's arm just below the elbow. So he had two severely crippling wounds, and he struggled to shore, and there were paramedics, and they attended to him very quickly. And they then got him to the hospital, and he survived. It was a close call, but he survived. Now, if there's anyone you would think who would have reason to hate animals, to have animus toward other creatures, it would be someone who had a bitter experience like this, someone who was permanently disabled as a consequence of an animal attack. But Chuck Anderson, just a few years later, found himself up on Capitol Hill with eight other victims of shark attacks, not lobbying for the extermination or extirpation of sharks, but lobbying for an end to shark finning, where people catch the sharks, bring them on board, slice off their dorsal fin, throw the living carcass back in the water, so the animal dies a slow death from blood loss, all to make shark fin soup, which is consumed in certain Asian American communities and also in China. It's estimated that 73 million sharks are killed for shark fin soup in the world. So to think of all of that death and all that destruction, all that suffering, just for a bowl of soup, when we can obviously substitute any ingredient, we can have, you know, a wonderful culinary experience without engaging in this behavior. But I think if Chuck Anderson can sacrifice that much, if he can forgive, if he can put his bitter experience behind and actually advocate for the very animals that caused him some harm, what about us? Animals enrich our lives so much. We haven't been attacked, I mean, the vast majority of us, by animals. We haven't had a terrible experience with them. It doesn't really involve that much sacrifice. It just involves our being a decent person and alert to the suffering of these other creatures. So I thank you for coming tonight. I hope you read the book. It was really a life's work for me, and I wrote it so we could have this discussion all across the country about our responsibilities to animals. Thanks very much. And I think we've got two microphones, so if you want to raise your hands, we'll deliver the mic, and then we'll get somebody else in the queue, and we'll just rotate. So why don't we take the first gentleman here in the third row, and then why don't you raise a hand over here, and we can have our other mic carrier deliver that. Yes, sir.
When elected officials vote in ways that defend and perpetuate the abuse of animals, like the Missouri state legislators did recently when they repealed the anti-puppy mill law, and the Iowa legislators did when they voted to ban undercover investigations of factory farms, they need, in their next election campaigns to feel the wrath of an organized, politically mobilized animal welfare movement. How can we make the abuse and cruelty they voted to defend and perpetuate a decisive issue in their next election campaigns?
You know, well said. Just to give you a little more hope on that, in Iowa, there's a bill that's been introduced to make it a crime to take pictures of animals on factory farms. So it's designed really as a counterweight to the Humane Society and other groups that have hired undercover investigators to expose abusive practices at slaughter plants and factory farms. And it's really an admission by agribusiness that I think they've got something to hide, and it's also an admission that we're making progress. The bill has passed one chamber. It still needs to be considered in the Senate, so it's not done yet, and we're hoping to block it. In Missouri, Missouri's constitution allows for citizen initiatives, and in November, voters, at the urging of HSUS and other animal welfare groups, passed a comprehensive ballot measure that was actually modeled after the Pennsylvania 2008 anti-puppy mill law that was enacted, that former Governor Rendell really helped drive to passage, along with many different organizations that were involved. So Missouri's House and Senate have now voted to repeal the ballot measure. The bill is on the governor's desk, and we're not sure what he's going to do with it. He may try to offer a compromise. That's what he's been talking about. That's pretty unsatisfactory to us at the Humane Society, and we are going to continue to fight that issue and may resort to doing another ballot initiative to give the people a second crack at the issue. But your broader point is exactly right. You know, we cannot expect multi-billion-dollar industries, whether it's agribusiness or animal testing or the trapping lobby or whatever it is, and there are so many of them, just to kind of cave in when we make a moral argument. I mean, we're in a political struggle. Just like there have been political struggles in the past over civil rights or other big questions of the day. And if we expect to just win the argument and for these folks to go away, we're being extraordinarily naive. Like any social movement that's in a competitive political environment, we have to organize. I mean, we formed a political arm called the Humane Society Legislative Fund. We've got our 501c3 organization that can do a limited amount of lobbying, but then we've got a new political arm that can do unlimited lobbying and get involved in elections. And that's what we need to do. There's a fledgling PAC here in Pennsylvania called Humane USA Pennsylvania PAC that's starting to give money to candidates who care about animals and starting to campaign against candidates who take the wrong posture on animal issues. That needs to grow. And you look at any cause out there, if they've got a serious level of organization, they're doing that. We can't suspend our operations. You know, that's why I say that, we have to focus on rescue and helping animals in crisis, but we also need to work on the front end, and we need to get the right people in office, because we'll be rescuing animals forever if we don't figure out why they're in crisis in the first place. Was there a question over here? Hand raised? Yes, okay, on the right side of the room again. And then there's one back behind. If you want to run over to the other side, up the aisle on the right-hand side.
Okay. There's such an incredible disconnect between the food that's on our plate and where the meat actually comes from. I mean, the words are even different that we use, cow and meat and pork. And I mean, it would be interesting if, a mom said to a kid, do you want cow for dinner or pig for dinner? And I mean, there's such a huge disconnect. So how do we begin to bridge that divide, particularly with kids, and helping them understand where their food is actually coming from, and then that food is the pig that they learned about when they were in school today?
Well, somebody, I was on WHYY today, and this issue came up, and Marty, the host, asked me, if people are in denial about their food choices. And, I think that we are, to some degree. I think that we're beginning to think a little bit more about becoming conscious eaters. I mean, Oprah has talked about being a conscious eater. Michael Pollan wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma. Eric Schlosser wrote Fast Food Nation. They were really starting to have a bigger discussion about our responsibilities. And, you know, when I look at the threats to animals, I mean, I'm really concerned about the puppy mills. I'm concerned about euthanasia of animals in shelters. I'm concerned about the seals. But all of that is dwarfed by the number of animals raised for food. I mean, it's 10 billion animals. There are more animals that go through slaughter lines in the United States than there are people on the planet. 10 billion a year. And most of them are raised in these factory farming conditions. So, you know, I guess, you know, some of us have chosen to kind of not participate in that process and become vegetarians or vegans. There are a lot of others who care about animals and aren't prepared to take that complete step. And I want to encourage them to do any little thing. You know, there's a Meatless Mondays campaign. There are more and more products that are produced by farmers who raise animals in extensive systems. There's a big campaign to reduce the total amount of meat, milk, and eggs that people are consuming. I think all of these things are good. I think just take little steps and, you know, do something, because every little thing you do has consequences when you're talking about 10 billion. I mean, if we reduced our consumption by 10% in the United States of meat, we would save a billion animals. I mean, just with this simple choice, I mean, what kind of sacrifice is it to reduce your meat consumption by 10%? That is an incredible yield. I mean, the animals, this is supply and demand. The animals are raised because people are consuming them. And I think that what, you know, just to get to the central kind of argument on your question, we try to separate ourselves from animals when we want to exploit them. We try to objectify them. You can look at the language. You know, you talk about tools, you know, animals in labs sometimes are called tools for research in some of the journals. In some of the game management publications, the animals are crops to be harvested on a sustained yield basis. The animals on some of the farms are units of production. I mean, the language separates us. And this was the point of my book, is that there's a bond. We've got to connect with these animals. And when you have these factory farms and you have millions of animals and you have a couple of operators of the farm, that's not farming. There's no farming going on. There's just kind of mass confining of animals. And I think we do have to talk more honestly about these issues. And this effort in Iowa that the gentleman mentioned toward the front is an attempt to kind of cut off that discussion. We need that discussion very badly. Yes, how about over here on this? Okay, sure.
Mr. Pacelli, with the exception of farm animals and their species, no other species suffers more than feral cats in this nation. I have looked and studied trap, neuter, return, manage for over 10 years, and these caregivers are not able to keep up with the proliferation and the of the suffering of these animals, these unaltered, mostly domestic cats. Can the Humane Society, along with your leadership, step up its priorities and really start handling on a state level for mandatory spay and neuter for domestic cats? I don't know the model law language that would protect caregivers and whatnot and breeders, but can the Humane Society elevate this problem and really take a hold and try to do something about it?
You're talking about feral cats and the numbers proliferating, and that the current investment that's being made by the cat caregivers is not enough to deal with the problem. Is that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're behind every college campus, every apartment building, every supermarket,
yeah,
and every municipality and every county in every state.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the book, I really, you know, give a shout out to this incredible network of incredibly selfless people who are doing trap, neuter, return work and trying to humanely manage these colonies and manage them out of existence through trapping them, sterilizing them, and then releasing them. And it is an awesome task. I really do agree with you that there are so many animals at risk. Let me just say that the Humane Society is one group, and we have just an enormous set of responsibilities. We do have a feral cat program, and we've got a manager of our program. But all of these things that we're talking about are going to require policymakers, and it's going to require average citizens getting involved to address these problems. There's no easy solution on that one. I will tell you that I'm really excited, and I mentioned this in the book as well, about active research to develop a chemical, non-surgical sterilant. And right now, there's the way that spaying neutering occurs is it's a surgical procedure conducted by a veterinarian. It's costly, relatively speaking. It's time-consuming. It requires that the animal, you know, be physically handled and often held overnight. And a non-surgical sterilant would be an enormous advance, and it would be one of those innovations that would be part of the new humane economy. And I think that that's where we're going to see the greatest results, is with some development in technology like that. We've already developed an immunocontraceptive vaccine for wild horse populations. Rather than having the federal government round them up and put them in holding facilities and hope to adopt them, they've rounded up way too many to be adopted. So we have 30,000 horses in captive settings that have been taken off our federal lands. We should be managing them on the range with a contraceptive vaccine that can balance the interests of our competing public land users. We can control the horse population, but do it humanely and not be causing all this cruelty that they're enduring. Yes?
I have a question. Oops, sorry. What's the difference between shark fin soup and any other non-vegan food? Because all non-vegan foods lead to unnecessary death suffering of animals. So what's the difference between something like shark fin soup or anything else?
Well, you know, I think every issue has its own dynamics. I think your point is that, you know, we don't need meat to survive, and that it's a choice that we're making.
It's not vegan.
Right, anything that's not vegan, right. It's true. I mean, a vegan diet is certainly one that is healthful, and we don't need animal products to survive. I do think that there are practices that are more wasteful, more extreme, more cruel than others. I think that an animal raised in an extensive environment and killed quickly is different than one who has a body part hacked off and then they're dumped in the water. I think of foie gras as something that is a particularly frivolous and harmful production practice, where you force feed ducks or geese to the point that their liver swells to 10 times its normal size, then you kill the duck or the goose just to take out the liver and eat this product as a table treat. I mean, I do think there are gradations, but I think your point, which you're conveying to the audience here, is that we should think about the issue comprehensively, and I would agree that everyone should think about it comprehensively. One more question we're going to take over here.
Hello. I was just curious, you know, oftentimes I've read news articles on animal cruelty, and when people actually go under the legal system, and there are times where you just read about horrific things and people maybe get a couple of hours community service, or they get a, you know, month of jail time, and they get, you know, 29 days probation or something crazy like that. And I was just wondering, like, A, which are the states that have the toughest anti-cruelty penalties, and which states need more work? And for the states that do need more work, how could we go about trying to get the legislature to implement stricter penalties?
Yes. Well, you know, there's been a real sea change on this issue. It continues to be something that must be worked on. But when I started in animal advocacy in the late 1980s, there were very few states that had felony-level penalties for any form of cruelty. And now Mississippi just became the latest state, 47th state, to have felony penalties for certain acts of cruelty. The last two states that had misdemeanor penalties for dogfighting changed their laws in 2008, so all 50 states have felony-level penalties for dogfighting. And cockfighting, which was legal in five states just 12 or 13 years ago, is outlawed everywhere, and it's a felony in 39 states. I think that we've got to do a few things. We've got to continue to strengthen the laws. We've got to get judges and prosecutors to take these matters with the seriousness that they warrant. And the public has to affirm a vigorous prosecution of people who are perpetrating these acts of cruelty. And I really see this as one the public is really starting to get it. It's not just an issue of the animal cruelty, which alone warrants strong penalties and vigorous prosecution, but people really get that when you're cruel to animals, there are other dangerous tendencies that people are often exhibiting. And we're seeing more and more people actually doing time, but it requires constant vigilance. It requires good public officials to take their jobs very seriously. So it goes back to this gentleman who asked the first question. We need good people serving. We need people who are aware of these issues, and we need to hold them accountable. So I really do want to thank you. I'll be signing books upstairs, and in addition to hoping that you'll read the book and spread the word and share the book with others, I hope you'll get involved in the broader cause. I hope that you'll get our email alerts at humanesociety.org. I hope you'll read my blog, which I write each weekday. I hope you'll participate in the presence of such a significant moral question that we're facing today about how we're going to treat our animals in our society. We can't be bystanders. We can't leave it up to somebody else to settle these questions. We have to jump in. We have to jump into the marketplace. We have to jump into the political process. We have to jump into the education arena. We have to really ring the bell and let people know that there's a serious question upon us. So thank you all very much, and I look forward to talking to you more.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.